Stand under a tree in just about any weather and you'll hear sounds from it. Maybe not directly from it, but the sound of the wind moving the leaves and branches, or the sound of the rain splatting on it, or the sound of birds flying in and out of the tree, or just sitting and singing. Just those examples, wind, rain, birds, give you a clue to the importance of trees to many other parts of the environment. Our guest this hour celebrates trees and their importance to so much else in his book, The Songs of Trees, Stories from Nature's Great Connectors. This is the work of David George Haskell, who comes at science from several angles. His work pulls together science, literature, and contemplative studies of the natural world. David is a professor of biology and environmental studies at the University of the South in Tennessee. His 2012 book, The Forest Unseen, was an award winner and a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize. Welcome, David George Haskell.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's a great pleasure to be here.
So in The Forest Unseen, your geographical scope was fairly narrow. How about this book?
Yes, in The Forest Unseen, I studied one square meter of forest through the year, returning again and again to that place to understand its ecological stories and how it changed through the seasons, and to follow those changes back into the ecology and evolution that lies behind that. And I took a similar spirit in this next book to particular trees located in different parts of the world. So some, one in Ecuador in the rainforest, in Jerusalem, Scotland, Colorado, Manhattan. And again, although the particular places were more widely spread geographically, I returned again and again to each individual tree to sit, to listen, to observe stories.
Stories. So what were you seeking to find from any of the trees?
So each tree comes from a long evolutionary heritage, of course, so it has its family story. It also has the story of its place, how it relates to the physical and biological environment in every location. And that environment includes humans. So part of what I was seeking is to understand how trees are connected to humans, how we are networked to the lives of trees. And one of my claims in the book is that life at a biological level isn't just interconnected, it's actually made from those connections. If you take the connections away, the creatures fall out of existence, and that's as much the case for humans as it is for trees. So the book centers on trees, but through those trees, we hear stories that are about people and about the larger ecosystems in which each tree finds its life.
In fact, the most clear statement very early in the book is life is embodied network. What does that mean?
Absolutely. So the life being embodied network is a rather abstract idea, and what I try to do is explore this through the actual particularities of each tree. So, for example, if we start at the roots of a tree, a tree root, at least when I was in high school, was described as this conduit made out of cells that reaches down into the soil and draws up water and nutrients. So it was a self, if you like. It was just one entity growing in the soil. Now, from our studies of modern genetics and biochemistry, we know that the tree root has its life only through relationship with other creatures. So there's a halo of bacteria that lives, that wraps the tree root. And the bacteria and the plant cells signal to one another, back and forth, to their DNA, at the level of DNA. And without those signals, the tree root can't live. The same is true of the fungi that actually penetrate into the interior of the root. So the root is made not just from one type of cells, but from plant cells, bacterial cells, fungal cells. And in that conversation between the cells, and by conversation I mean a chemical exchange in this case, where signals from one genome are sent to another, in that conversation, the tree grows, it finds minerals and water, and so the above-ground part of the tree that we see is really a manifestation of a great big below-ground community of interactions.
This sounds somewhat similar to the idea of the human microbiome, where we've got all kinds of things living inside of us that we need there to keep us alive.
Absolutely. So this is one of the things that transcends all life forms that we know of, that the human body is not just made out of human cells, it's made out of bacterial and fungal cells that affect not just things that one would expect, like our digestion, but affect the texture of our mind. As our microbiome in our gut changes, we feel happier or more depressed. So our consciousness, in a strange way, is a product of a community. a community of bacterial and human cells, not just of the human nervous system, as we had been thinking about it. The same is true for trees, and it turns out that because trees are, of course, rooted in place, they don't have the option of moving around except when they send pollen and seeds out into the world. For the trees, the network is what forms their being. So they're more networked than humans in that they have deep physical connections in both their leaves and their roots to the other creatures and the environment around them. And so that's one of the reasons I picked trees for this book. They're just wonderful exemplars of the many ways that life now is, with in biology and ecology, we're thinking more about life as a network rather than a collection of separate individuals that interact.
The book is called The Songs of Trees, Stories from Nature's Great Connectors. David George Haskell is the author and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk about the specific trees he visited in different parts of the world and studied and spent a fair amount of time with when we come back from the break. Before we get to that break, let me remind you that it is day 6 of a 7-day spring fund drive here on Jefferson Public Radio. We are seeking pledges of support to make certain that we can continue to provide programs like the Jefferson Exchange in the years ahead. The phone number for pledges 888-552-6191, or you can pledge online at ijpr.org. Your listening is always appreciated. Your support is appreciated as well. Thank you so much for listening and giving financial support to Jefferson Public Radio. Back with David George Haskell and the Songs of the Trees on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to David George Haskell, a professor of biology and environmental studies at the University of the South in Sewanee, Tennessee. He's written another book about trees to follow up his highly lauded 2012 book, The Forest Unseen. This latest one is called The Songs of Trees, Stories from Nature's Great Connectors. He visited trees around the world and studied them and spent lots of time with them, with a real intense focus from several angles, because David does come at this as a scientist, a literature person, and he's also into contemplative studies. So this is what the Songs of Trees is about. You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we talk about connectivity in the environment. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So moving on to the individual trees, David, how did you choose which trees to profile?
So I chose the trees partly through my trees that were located in places that I was visiting already, and I wanted to befriend a tree and learn more about its life. For example, my work takes me to Manhattan fairly often, and so I wanted to find a tree there that I could spend some time with every time I was passing through the city. Other trees were located where I knew there would be a convergence of interesting stories. So one tree is in Jerusalem. It's an olive tree. And, of course, the olive has been the tree that has kept humans alive in that region for thousands of years. It produces a lot of, as any cook knows, a lot of really great oil from a rather arid environment. Another tree is in Ecuador in the western Amazon rainforest, where the biodiversity is absolutely phenomenal. It just blew every single sense in my body, blew me away when I was there. This incredibly diverse place and a very threatened place because oil drilling is moving into this region. So I wanted to be in a place where the effects of fossil fuel extraction were perhaps most clearly manifest in their interaction with biodiversity. And then other trees were places, perhaps unexpected places, like a road construction site in Scotland where people have unearthed charcoal. So little pieces of charcoal from the very first campfires made by people who colonized that region after the ice ages retreated. And so people's lives have been tied up with fire from wood from the very beginning of humans, and that continues to the present day. Right next to these ancient charcoal campfires is a modern coal-fired power plant, and that power plant is producing electricity, and it may be replaced by a power plant that imports wood from the United States to Scotland to burn as a green fuel, a supposedly green fuel, to to power their economy.
Well, a full circle on charcoal then.
Exactly. So we've got all sorts of ways of burning wood from different periods of life's history embedded, all wrapped up in one place.
So let's talk about the individual trees. You mentioned the one in Ecuador. That's the sabo tree. Can you give us some broad brush information about it?
Yes. Yeah, so the sabo tree is an enormous tree. It towers over all the other trees in the rainforest canopy, and it draws life into its being. So there are hundreds of other species wrapped up in the branches, hanging in great vines. And you climb up. I climb to the very top of this tree, and you get a view, a great panoramic vista over the green rainforest all around, with macaws flying overhead and frogs chirping in the rain. So it really is a center of diversity. And the Warani, who are the local indigenous group who've lived in the region for thousands of years, regard the sabo as a tree of life. And the way they describe it actually reflects and anticipates, I'd say, a lot of the discoveries of Western science. They refer to the tree as a networked being, that it isn't an individual. In fact, they have, in their language, no names for plants, say a plant species now that we would describe, say, a ponderosa pine. Well, they don't have a name for a species that's just an individual moniker. They describe a species in terms of its relationships with others, its place in the community. So biology and culture converge on the same understanding of the interconnectedness of life around the sabo tree.
We have actually a clip from this project, an actual sound clip of what it's like in the general vicinity of a sabo tree. So let's hear just a little bit of that. That's quite a cacophony, David. What are all the creatures going on about there?
Okay, great. So here we're hearing dawn in the top of the sabo tree, the roaring sound of the howler monkeys. We're hearing some macaws, the wind blowing through about a dozen different types of leaves. Each leaf makes its own wind sound, and we hear that also when it rains. We hear insects and frogs waking up. So at dawn, there's this great surge of acoustic energy that wraps the sabo tree. That acoustic energy is a manifestation of the diversity and vitality of the place.
So while you're appreciating all this life, I wonder how concerned you were for your own. You go on to describe a fair number of dangers in the forest there.
Yes, so the forest, particularly for people who don't know, like myself, I didn't grow up there. And even for the Warani who live there, it's a place where one needs to be cautious. A bullet ant bit me, and it was a very painful experience. Most of the plants are very heavily defended with chemicals. If you chew a leaf, you're likely to get very sick. There are spines everywhere. There are mosquitoes carrying viral diseases. So it's a place of great conflict and competition. And yet, the way that conflict and competition is resolved is not in a competitive way, it's through species and individuals forming alliances. And those alliances are so tight that individuality melts away. So the sabo tree's leaves and roots are a community. The ants that are gathering leaves are working, the ants ultimately eat those leaves, by working with fungi that then have bacterial cooperators. And so in every single case that people have examined in the rainforest, there's an alliance between multiple species that allows life in this very vigorous, challenging place. And so in the Amazon, we see this in a very crisp, intense way. The same truth is present even in a place that's much less diverse, like on a street tree, on a city street. It also exists and lives through alliance with other organisms, including its alliances with people who care for it.
I must say, you've gotten me to think about trees in ways I had never thought about them before. I mean, I was aware of the fact that lots of critters live in them way high up, particularly in the really tall trees like the redwoods. But the fact that it is different things to different creatures, that we experience trees on the ground with the trunks and the shade from the leaves, and yet there are flying things that experience the trees in very different ways far up above, and then down below, other creatures that have very different functions in the world that relate to the trees in very different ways themselves.
Absolutely. So there are multiple worlds present in any one tree. And in fact, the largest world in the tree is the places we can't access. So the root tips are covered in and filled with life. And then in the canopy, if you think of the surface area represented by each leaf, whether it's a pine needle or, a maple leaf, a flap leaf, that's an enormous surface area. If you spread that out over the forest floor, it might, on a very big tree, it would cover dozens, maybe hundreds of square meters. And so the available habitat for other creatures in the canopy is just extraordinary. And in some places, the canopy, particularly in older trees, the canopy is comprised of multiple microhabitats. So in the sabo tree, in each hectare of forest, has tens of thousands of gallons of water up in the canopy, held in bromeliads and held in little knot holes in the tree, where there are frogs and insects that never come to ground. They have their life in these aerial wetlands. So we walk through the forest, and in fact, there is a lake up above our head, held within the little crooks of trees and in the gaps between leaves and the stem.
David George Haskell is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a professor of biology and environmental studies at the University of the South in Tennessee. He's the author of several books, including this latest one, The Songs of Trees, Stories from Nature's Great Connectors. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. We've just talked about the sabo tree, C-E-I-B-O, in Ecuador. The next tree is far away in Ontario. What is significant about the balsam fir?
The balsam fir is a tree that is very important in the economy of timber. So it's used for timber and for paper. So anyone who's read a book or a magazine has probably held some balsam fir in their hands. And that paper, of course, is used to connect human minds. So there's in a way, wood is connecting, is networking humans. We've worked with cellulose to help human culture spread between little points of consciousness in people's minds. And the same is true of music, of course. Most music emerges from the vibrations of wood. So people, again, combine their creativity with the physical properties of wood to connect one to another. In the case of the balsam fir in Ontario, this tree first was an example of the many ways in which the great northern forests, the boreal forests, are important to the global carbon cycle. They draw down a lot of carbon from the atmosphere and store it in the soil. And then below that, these fir trees were growing on rocks that were 1.5 billion years old, containing some of the oldest fossils known anywhere in the planet. And these little remnants, these billion-year-old remnants of bacterial fossils, were already networked. So the balsam fir was a reminder that these biological networks go all the way back to the origin of life. And now chemists and biologists who are studying the chemical origin of life talk not of the evolution of self-replicating organisms, but of networks of chemicals that work on one another to produce a system that perpetuates itself. What evolves, what persists through time, is a network of relationships, not a particular singular self that clones and copies.
Sort of like this species works as the midwife for the other species or something like that?
Yes, and even below the level of the species, one chemical A, brings chemical B into being, chemical B brings chemical C into being, and then C produces A. So that's the simplest network possible, a triangle between A, B, C. The relationships continue through time, but A might be replaced by D down the line, or maybe you add another little branch in the network. So the network persists, but any individual component of it changes and may pass away. And of course, that's true at the level of our own lives. We are made from relationships among people, with bacteria, with the food we eat, with every breath we take in. We will pass away, but the networks that formed us and that we contribute to are both our origin and our legacy.
It's in this section of the book on the balsam fir that you say that the balsam fir is a behaving and thinking creature, and then a few pages later you say the forest thinks, and you insist that's not an anthropomorphism.
Right. So, yes, there's one way of saying that the forest thinks that I think is not accurate, and that is that the forest would think in the same way as a human mind does. And, of course, the human mind is comprised mostly of human neurons, and as we discussed earlier, some bacteria form part of that network. The forest makes its decisions in a much more diffuse network of birds and trees and bacteria and below-ground fungi, all interacting with each other in a way that is analogous to a human mind. Human mind is also a networked organic being. The forest retains memory within its network, makes decisions, evolves, has creativity, it changes through time. And if we're willing to expand the notion of what intelligence and mind is, the forest has all of those properties that we associate with human mind, but made of a different sort of connections, a more diverse set of connections. So I don't imagine that the forest's thoughts and mind are exactly parallel to ours in the most literal sense, but in the sense of patterns that retain memories and that show creativity and intelligence, absolutely, the forest is a thinking being.
David George Haskell is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called The Songs of Trees, Stories from Nature's Great Connectors. I want to move on to the next clip we have available, which is of sable palm. And from the sound of it, people might guess where this tree lives. All right, so David, fill us in. Where does a sable palm obviously is going to live in some place where it's fairly warm? Can we guess this is the ocean?
Yes. So you're hearing the water there, and that recording was made with a hydrophone. I dropped a hydrophone next to the roots of this palm tree that is growing on an island on the coast of southeastern coast of the United States, an island off the coast of Georgia near Savannah, Georgia, and this is a barrier island made of sand. It was deposited into a ridge off the coast, and that deposition happened during the retreat of the last ice age. And the palm tree lives on the edge of the ocean, and it turns out that this palm tree, as all other members of its species, is a master at dealing with really, really hostile conditions. There's a lot of wind. There's a lot of salt. The sun in the summertime just beats down and desiccates the palm fronds. So we tend to think of palm trees on beaches as symbols of relaxation. For the palm, it's a symbol of some rather hard work and a very rigorous lifestyle. And the palm trees have been doing this for millions of years, and so we can learn from their lives, from their physiology, how is it that organisms cope with such a challenging environment? And we need to think about this question now, of course, because sea levels are coming up. Within the next 50 to 100 years, we can expect sea levels to go up by half a meter and a half, maybe several meters, depending on which model and projection we look at. And our human method of dealing with this so far has been to ignore and to try to resist. The palm tree teaches us that you can do that for a certain time, and then you have to move. You have to adapt. And so in the palm tree, we see both the ancient history of life and how creatures have adapted to challenging environments. And we get some suggestions for perhaps the future, how we might adapt and deal with the coming crisis of climate change, when up to 2% of the human population will lose their houses to flooding. The projected sea level rise will wipe out those coastal areas. And then beyond that, people subject to storms and high spring tides and so forth, that's another several hundred million people who will be affected by that. So these are serious issues, and I do think that biology, given that species have been coping with climate change for millions of years, can teach us something about the best ways of adapting and, of course, mitigating and perhaps preventing some of these projected calamities.
We have more trees to talk about and more interconnections to discuss with David George Haskell, who's the author of the book, The Songs of Trees, Stories from Nature's Great Connectors. We'll resume that in a couple of minutes. As we lead up to the break, let me remind you, it is day six of a 7-day spring fund drive here on Jefferson Public Radio, in which we are seeking your support in really an all-hands-on-deck kind of situation, because we have never before faced a budget proposal that would just eliminate all funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. But that is what the White House has presented to Congress. Congress may decide to do something different. There are lots of friends of public broadcasting on both sides of the aisle in Congress, so we're hoping that the outcome's a little better than zero. But we don't know. So we've asked for a higher total this time, $200,000. We're well on the way there. We hope you will take your time to make a pledge of support, either online at ijpr.org or over the phone at 888-552-6191. Back with the Songs of Trees on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Down to the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We get to spend a few more minutes talking about trees with David George Haskell, who is a big fan of trees, professor of biology and environmental studies at the University of the South in Tennessee. His work pulls together science, literature, and contemplative studies of the natural world. His latest book is called The Songs of Trees, Stories from Nature's Great Connectors. We learn a lot about how interconnected life is in the forest and how trees are great relayers of information from portions of the environment to the other. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email as jx@jeffnet.org. We have been talking about the sable palm, which you found in coastal Georgia on a barrier island. And there's some interesting stuff you pull into this part of the book, too, about beachcombing records from the 19th century and now. And whose records did you fall upon from the 19th century?
Yes. So, what I learned very quickly at the sable palm was that the tree was in conversation with the ocean, and all sorts of things would wash up around the tree and get caught in it from the ocean there. And it turns out that, of course, I'm not the only person who's noted this thing. And Thoreau, back in the 1840s and 50s, was walking along Cape Cod and wrote about this in one of his collections of essays, all the different things that he found along the beach in Cape Cod, bricks and soap bars and water-soaked nutmegs and boxes and barrels, and 29 human cadavers. There had been a wreck of Irish immigrants coming across to the United States as what we would now refer to as environmental refugees and refugees fleeing political persecution.
That was an amazing. I can't believe that it was so casual, though, that Thoreau would just think, there were 29 cadavers down there, and just sort of as a recording with the barrels and the nutmegs and everything else.
Right, exactly. And so Thoreau, to modern ears, he sounds almost a little callous. He says he sympathized rather with the winds and the waves, believing the Irish had emigrated to a newer world where they kissed the shore in rapture. Why waste any time in awe or pity? Now, at his time, there were wrecks on Cape Cod every fortnight through the winter. And in the U.S., the Irish were, of course, not held in much esteem. It was a country with maybe 20 million people, and 1 million people were fleeing to the United States. So it was a very large wave of immigration, and Thoreau was managed to basically tune himself out of much empathy in that situation. And when we think, well, that's not us, we're not like that anymore, but it turns out, of course, now in just the last few years, great waves of migration, of people fleeing environmental change and political persecution, are happening around the world, and beaches in the Mediterranean and in the Middle East are once again, cadavers are washing up, and holiday goers are sauntering past them, giving not too much of a thought. So we're back in that world of mass migration across oceans, driven by now not the decisions of English politicians and of people's dependence on one species or one variety of potato, but by other environmental changes, increasing spread of deserts, people running out of rainwater, overpopulation, and all interacting with war in several parts of the world. And this is one of the themes that I explore in another chapter in discussing the history of olives in the Middle East, that changes in rainfall and then human society, whether we can live in peace with one another, have determined the fate of whether people and trees can live together on the land. And when they can, we gain lots of food and shelter. And when we cannot, civilizations collapse. There are portions of Middle East history where people and olive trees are literally wiped off the map by a combination of drought and war. And hopefully we are not returning to that situation. But the trends for water stress and for conflict are unfortunately pointing in that direction.
Well, and there's another discussion of water and how humans use water in a chapter on cottonwood trees. And you start right there in Denver, and it's interesting how you include how changing river flows with dams have affected tree species. Like how?
Yes. So the cottonwood depends on cycles of flooding to regenerate. So the cottonwood seeds blow onto the river and then get carried to the high banks during floods. And then as the flood recedes, the little seedling germinates and sends its root down, 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 down into the sand, keeping up with the water, sucking at the water. And then if the flood recedes at the right pace and the root can grow down fast enough, the cottonwood then grows into a sapling and eventually into a large tree. But with dams, you tend to have either a very consistent flow where there's no flooding to help plant the cottonwood seedlings on the edge of the river, or you have great big enormous floods followed by stillness. And so the pattern, the rhythm, if you like, the rhythmicity of the river has changed, and the cottonwood finds itself a little bit out of place. Now, it turns out that what the chapter about cottonwoods is a hopeful chapter in that the river management in a lot of places in the arid parts of the West has now reflected some of these ecological needs. We're moving in the right direction. And the rivers, the cottonwood in that particular chapter is right in the middle of Denver, in a place that used to be an industrial dump that no one in their right mind would wander into. Now it's a place that's been cleaned up. There are parks and bike lanes, and people are swimming there on warm summer afternoons, a thing that was unimaginable back in the 70s. And then, through the concerted action of people trying to bring beauty back to the city, not just to protect beautiful places, but to find places of ugliness and restore them, has wrapped human intention into the river, and now human lives and the life of the river and the trees and other creatures around the river are much more tightly twined, and it's a much more wonderful place to be. And now, of course, There are new apartments and condos going up, and people want to be around the river and want to stay in downtown, whereas a few decades ago, everyone was fleeing out to the suburbs to get away from what was a nasty, polluted place.
So we can restore urban environments if we think in terms of nature as well?
Absolutely, and I think I would argue that, in fact, an urban environment is just as natural as out in the forest. It's just that the urban environment emerges mostly from the mind of one natural species, and that's the human species. We're as natural as a redwood tree. It doesn't mean that every one of our actions is good or right, even though it might be natural. Now, what we can do is through our intention, through planning, through the human social network, bring about a healthy environment both for humans and other species in urban areas. And we're seeing this not just in the United States, but around the world, the greater awareness of this, that not only do we increase human quality of life, but we burn less fossil fuels, we provide habitat for species that were either eliminated or endangered within urban environments. So I do think that there is a movement, a very encouraging movement, that regards people as part of the community of life. And so places like cities where people are quite dominant, well, we should invite the rest of the community of life into those places, both for the benefit of other species and for our own benefit.
So not as masters of the domain, but as a part of a larger whole.
Exactly. So thinking of ourselves as belonging rather than as being somehow separate.
All right. The book is called The Songs of Trees, Stories from Nature's Great Connectors. It is the latest work of David George Haskell, who teaches at the University of the South in Tennessee. His previous book was The Forest Unseen, which was an award winner and, in fact, a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize. David, it's been a pleasure to meet you and talk to you about trees today. Thank you for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I hope you'll keep your ears open for more tree songs in your neighborhood.
I will be listening. Thank you. Okay.